From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Oliver Stone, the director of Platoon, Nixon, JFK, Natural Born Killers, and Any Given Sunday. There are two new DVD box sets of his movies. Also, La Tigra, a band with a punk sensibility and a feminist attitude. We hear from two members of the band, Johanna Fateman and Kathleen Hanna. La Tigra has a new CD. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie Pollock, starring Ed Harris as Jackson Pollock. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. and British warplanes attacked five Iraqi military sites near Baghdad today. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Pentagon officials say that the Iraqi air defense system has been acting with greater accuracy and frequency in the last couple of months. They say that U.S. pilots reported Iraqi surface-to-air missiles coming more frequently and coming closer, that they were more accurate. And one of the reasons they figured is that the Iraqi air defense system was getting better command and control information, better radar information, because some of those facilities were operating outside the no-fly zone. Perhaps the Iraqis considered that those facilities were safe because they were outside the no-fly zone. In any case, U.S. military officials decided they needed to broaden their attacks.
NPR's Tom Gelton reporting from the Pentagon. California Governor Gray Davis has proposed that the state buy billions of dollars worth of electric transmission lines as part of a plan to save the state's two biggest utilities from bankruptcy. The Davis plan would require the parent companies of Southern California Edison and Pacific Gas and Electric to help pay off the utility's debts. The two utilities say that soaring costs for wholesale power have driven them nearly $13 billion in debt. One California assemblyman estimated that it would cost the state about $7 billion to buy the company's electric transmission lines. The White House says President Bush is prepared to sign an executive order aimed at cutting the amount of money organized labor can spend on politics. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
The order directs federal contractors to post notices about the Supreme Court's Beck decision. The decision says that if union workers object to having their dues money spent on political activities, they can opt out of the union. This is a step toward so-called paycheck protection. That's the idea, supported by President Bush and other Republicans, that unions should get members' permission for their high-budget, mostly pro-democratic campaigns. The Supreme Court issued the Beck decision in 1988, but it was little noticed until 1992. That spring, President Bush's father was running for re-election. He signed an executive order, like the one now being prepared, when the AFL-CIO was on the verge of endorsing his rival, Bill Clinton. Clinton defeated the elder Bush and promptly revoked the order. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
Commerce Secretary Don Evans says he'll decide whether the 2000 census should be adjusted to avoid undercounting minorities. The Clinton administration had planned to leave the politically sensitive decision to the Census Bureau and a board of career statisticians. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 92 points to close at 10,799. This is NPR News. Chinese state media reported today that a member of China's banned Falun Gong spiritual movement set himself ablaze in a Beijing street. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from Beijing.
State television showed police lifting the charred body of a man it said set fire to himself today in a neighborhood that is home to several Communist Party leaders. Official media reports said that a six-page suicide note was found that linked the man, an itinerant shoeshiner, to Falun Gong. The apparent suicide follows an incident in Beijing's Tiananmen Square 3 weeks ago, in which five people set themselves ablaze. The Chinese government claims they were all Falun Gong members, though spokesmen for the group abroad deny it. State media seized upon that incident as proof of government claims that Falun Gong is an evil cult and should be suppressed. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Beijing.
The deadline has passed for Timothy McVeigh to appeal for presidential clemency. The Oklahoma City bomber had until midnight last night to ask President Bush to spare his life. The date for McVeigh's execution has been set at May 16th. The Gulf War veteran stopped his appeals process earlier this year. From the time his execution date was set, McVeigh had 30 days to ask for executive clemency. His attorney said today that McVeigh didn't seek clemency because the likelihood of getting it was extremely small. The attorney, Rob Nye, also said that McVeigh doesn't want to look forward to a life of solitary confinement in prison. In stocks today, the technology-weighted NASDAQ Composite Index lost 128 points, or 5%. It closed at 2,425. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring public health initiatives such as HealthTrack, supporting tracking of chronic diseases and their environmental links, health-track.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Most of Oliver Stone's movies are collected on a new DVD box set. It comes in two editions, one with 6 films, the other with 10. Each edition includes extra scenes and Stone's commentary. His films include Platoon, Salvador, Born on the 4th of July, Wall Street, The Doors, JFK, Natural Born Killers, and Any Given Sunday. Platoon and Born on the 4th of July drew on his experiences in Vietnam. When Platoon was released in 1986, it was considered by many to be the film that best conveyed what it felt like to be a grunt in Vietnam. Although the film was enough to discourage anyone from fighting in a jungle war, writer and director Oliver Stone enlisted and asked to fight back in 1967. He won a Purple Heart. On this archive edition, we have a 1990 interview with Stone.
The main character in Platoon drops out of college, and his analytical reason that he gives one of the soldiers who thinks that, you know, he's crazy for being this middle-class kid in the war. So the reason the Charlie Sheen character gives is, you know, why should only the poor people fight? What was your reason for enlisting?
Well, that was part of it. I felt a sense of that it was a wrong, the war was somehow wrongly fought. If only, if you could go to college to escape it. That if a war should be a democratic country, supposedly, therefore it should be fought along democratic principles. That means everybody goes, including senators' sons and the bankers' sons. And I think that very deeply bothered my sense of idealism about this country. And I did feel an obligation that I had to serve. I left Yale University and... there were other reasons, too. It wasn't just a sense of idealism. And there was a, personally, I did feel obligated. I wanted to see the war. I wanted to see war as a concept because I'd read about it in books and Hemingway. And I have to admit, it had a romantic appeal to me. And I knew it was going to be the last war of my generation, and I wanted to be there. I wanted to be part of the passion and peril of our times, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, you know.
How soon did it lose that romantic appeal?
First day in the bush, you know, I cut point, I think, in the 25th, they put the new guys right up, like in the movie. And I think I lost that sense of, you know, it was pretty, it was clear to me in the first few days that the guys there were not really fighting for an objective or with any kind of morale. They were fighting just to count the days until they left. So everybody in the unit would have, I got 85 days to go, I got 165 days to go. You know, everybody would talk about the days left, which is not the right way to, you know, to really fight a war.
Your father was a stockbroker. You'd gone to prep school in Yale. Were your parents pleased that you had enlisted? Is that what they wanted for you?
No, they were horrified. Dad was a big believer in fighting communism, and until they took his own son, you know, he didn't. No, they thought I should stay in college. I was crazy to give that up.
Was there an element of rebellion against your parents,
of course,
in the act of enlisting?
That was probably the third part of the whole thing. Was that it was something that they didn't want me to do, therefore I had to do it. Because, to be honest, I'd had it with my parents, you know. I'd had it with that whole way of life. Something was wrong in the American system, that as I had been educated to, and I think I was turning my back on the world as I knew it. I knew that it was, I didn't know what else there was, but I knew what I didn't want, which was to become some version of what my father was. Since then, I've grown to respect him enormously for what he's done, and to see the things he went through and understand better, but. At that time, I was pretty angry.
Were you a physical person, and did you feel like that you could handle yourself well physically when you got to Vietnam?
I thought I could. Yeah, I was a good athlete, and I did learn ultimately. At first, I don't think anybody's a great soldier right off the bat. I mean, combat conditions are so intense and unplanned for that you never can tell what's going to happen. And I got shot the first time in a major, in my first night ambush, I got shot, and then I got shot a second time. After that, I got pretty smart in a bush, and I could move well without being hurt. I was carrying a lot of weight. I would carry 60, 70 pounds, or sometimes less. And, you know, but there was no question that the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army, were probably the best light infantry, you know, up to that time. I mean, there were great soldiers, too. And I'm not saying we were bad. I think that we did a good job, but we were up against people that we could travel very light, you know, eat rice and didn't need hot baths or showers and didn't need hot food. You know, they lived close to the ground. We had too much. In Vietnam, we had too many support troops. It was 6 or 7 to 1. You know, we had too much rear echelon. It was, you know, I think the war, if assuming that it was going to be fought, and I don't think it should have, but it should have been fought more in a commando-style way, Israeli army kind of way.
Screenwriter and director Oliver Stone is my guest. This is a scene from his movie Platoon, which was based on his own experiences in Vietnam. Charlie Sheen plays a soldier who just arrived in Vietnam. This is a letter to his grandmother.
Somebody once wrote, "Hell is the impossibility of reason." That's what this place feels like, hell. I hate it already, and it's only been a week. The hardest thing I think I've ever done is go on point 3 times this week. I don't even know what I'm doing. A gook could be standing 3 feet in front of me, and I wouldn't know it. I'm so tired. We get up at 5 a.m., hump all day, camp around 4 or 5, dig a foxhole, eat, then put out an all-night ambush or a 3-man listening post in the jungle. It's scary because nobody tells me how to do anything because I'm new. Nobody cares about the new guys. They don't even want to know your name. The unwritten rule is a new guy's life isn't worth as much because he hasn't put his time in yet. And they say if you're going to get killed in the Nam, it's better to get it in the first few weeks. The logic being, you don't suffer that much. If you're lucky, you get to stay in the perimeter at night. And then you pull a 3-hour guard shift. So maybe you sleep 3-4 hours a night, but you don't really sleep.
What was the feeling about being in a jungle war that you most wanted to communicate in Platoon?
Point of view, the subjectivity, the sense of fear and chaos that you can understand what war really is, the confusion, the fact that maybe 20% of what happens in the people who get killed in a war get killed by their own friendly fire, the sense of fear and panic. And heroism, too. There's daily acts of heroism. There's a bonding between the men. There was very much a split in Vietnam that I noticed. I was in 4 different platoons. I was in the 1st Cav and the 25th. And in all platoons, there was like a mini civil war going on. There was sort of the people that kind of believed in it, and the lifers, and then the people that, you know, were just draftees. There was the guys who smoked a little pot, and there were guys who drank too much. There was guys who liked Smokey Robinson. There was guys who liked country music. But there was generally a political split, you know. There was a certain element of racism, very strong racism towards the Orientals from portions of the platoon, you know, that they were less than human. And a lot of the other guys were more tolerant and humanitarian. So I found that interesting. I kind of thought that it reflected, in some ways, the split I saw in the United States when I went back to the country.
The kind of confusion that you're talking about in the middle of a jungle war, you captured that both in Platoon and in Born on the 4th of July. Can you talk a little bit about choreographing a scene so that what you get watching it is the sense of confusion of not knowing, not being able to see, not knowing who's fire in the middle of or who you're firing at. But from your perspective as a director, everything has to be completely controlled to communicate that confusion.
Well, it's very important to show that confusion. Very important. You do not see the enemy very often. In fact, in the movies that I made, you see them a little too much because I always had to, you know, I have to compromise to some degree with the needs of an audience, but it's even more difficult to see them. The tendency in a movie is to bring somebody who's firing at you a little closer to camera so that you can at least see some outlines. In real life, it was probably more invisible and dirtier and even more surprising. And death is even worse than it is on the screen. I mean, death is so, you know, it's pretty ugly. And it smells bad, too. I got Dale Dye to work with me. He's an ex-Marine, and he was real helpful. You know, we'd walk the terrain, and, you basically plot it out, do your homework. But we kept it spontaneous. We had a terrific cameraman, Bob Richardson. We had some great Steadicam operating. We did Bourne. We did completely different than Platoon.
What were the differences?
I wanted to go with a beach. I wanted to go with a yellow, blinding sky, because I worked up in the 1st Cav, up in the beach areas in the North, 1st Corps. And I remember patrolling those beaches, and there were little dangers there that you don't get in the jungle. And the sense of the sun, it reminded me of Camus' Stranger, and that Kovic would lose it, you know. He would just lose it in the sun and shoot his own man, you know, because he'd be blinded by the sunspots and sort of the panic, that crazy intent. You know, you don't, when the bullet flies, you're, everything, the same, the human beings all respond the same. The eyes tighten, the brains kind of go dead a little bit. You don't think that much, you know, when you're under fire. So we tried to do Bourne real different than Platoon because people had seen a lot of the jungles. I think that's one of the things I'm real proud of in Bourne is the ocean and the beach and the village.
Is there any one story that you would always tell the actors who you worked with in those movies about what the war was like?
No, we put them through training. And
right.
It was important that they not sleep. I remember in Platoon, and we put them through 12 days with Dye up in the Philippine bush. And I really insisted. I said, I don't want this well-slept look that I see in war movies. I want these guys to look tired and beaten. And you can't fake that for some reason. You can't put makeup under their eyes. You got to give them a sense of what it's like not to sleep for a year. You don't sleep at Nam. You get three hours if you're lucky. And 2 hours here, but you're always sleeping with radar on. So that's where you get that kind of vacant look. So we put him in the bush, and we worked him around the clock. We made him, you know, pull guard duty and sentry duty all night, and they came out. They were so angry and irritable. That's the irritability of infantry all over the world at any time. It's a given. And I think we caught that, and the guys got it. But you can never teach an actor exactly what it's like, you know. But they are very imaginative actors, and they are able to cross that gulf and imagine. But there's no substitute for actually being there.
My guest is Oliver Stone. Most of his movies are collected in a new DVD box set. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1990 interview with screenwriter and director Oliver Stone. Let's listen to a scene from his 1987 movie, Wall Street. Here's Michael Douglas as a ruthless arbitrager persuading a room full of stockholders to overthrow the company management.
I am not a destroyer of companies. I am a liberator of them. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you about the film Wall Street. Your father was or is a stockbroker.
Was a stockbroker.
Yes. Where would he have fit into that movie, if at all?
Dad would probably be a combination of Marty Sheen and Hal Holbrook. You know, he was the older broker, doing things a bit the old-fashioned way, And also a lot of the scenes between Marty and Charlie were kind of like scenes I based on my own relationship with Dad.
Did he want you to go into the business ever?
Oh, when I was young, yeah, before college. Yeah, he thought it would be a good way to make a living, you know. And but it was never, I never was any good at that. My mathematics were pretty dreadful. And as a matter of fact, I did terribly in economics, that's right. Freshman in college, I got a D or a C in economics. I just couldn't understand economics. It's very dismal.
But
he was good at it.
But I guess all that background helped you for the movie.
The mood of the movie, yeah. I found it very confusing, but I tried to clarify. I think I did a pretty good job of... Stanley Weiser, of course, helped me. He was my co-writer, but I think we clarified the a very difficult situation. We tried to make it clear, you know, the actual mechanics of what goes on and how buyouts are made and how you can make money off stock. But Dad wouldn't recognize the new Wall Street. They're moving huge amounts of volume. It's just jumped. I mean, it's really a computerized business now. In the old days, he was a customer's man. You know, you dealt with an individual group of clients. You took care of them over time. It was a relationship, like a banker with a small town or something like that. And he was also an economist. He wrote wonderful letters about economics for a monthly investment letter, which was very well respected in the 50s, 60s internationally. He considered himself really more of a writer than a really great businessman. But he would not recognize that Wall Street. The whole concept of making that money would elude him.
We're listening to an interview with Oliver Stone. When I spoke with him in 1990, he was in the process of wrapping up production on his film about the Doors.
It's going to be a big editing job. It's about 25 songs. It's a huge movie, 500,000 feet. I think it's going to take a lot of special effects, actually. We did
are these tripping special effects?
Tripping special effects. Right. And yeah, we're trying to play with colors and perception, the concept of, you know, psychological perception, how that changes, not just with tripping, but with, you know, with life itself, you know, the way things darken and lighten and shift in your consciousness. So it's a film very much about expansion of consciousness. You know, Jim was always after that. He was always trying to get through the barriers, trying to break through the limits of life.
What did Jim Morrison mean to you?
Well, pretty much that, you know, that he was for a PR phrase, I'd say, you know, an avatar of consciousness, you know, somebody who was, the theme of his life would be break on through to the other side, which is his anthem song, you know. He pushed things sexually, chemically, philosophically, poetry. I think success for him itself was a limitation. I think that the ultimate trip for him, I mean, I use the 60s word, the ultimate limitation, the last place to go, the last frontier for him was death. And I think that, you know, if you look at the poetry and the songs, death is mentioned frequently. He was half in love with death, as were the great romantic poets of the 19th century. And I think that was one of his visiting spots, one of his destinations.
What phase of your life are the Doors records associated with? Is it Vietnam? Is it being home afterwards?
I'd say a combination of 67, definitely late 67 in Vietnam, turning on to it with black guys, you know, listening to it and smoking marijuana, taking acid, and R&R trips down to Australia then going over to back to the States. And there was a run there about 68, 69. They were very much, I was big fans of Jim and the Doors. And then, you know, they were never that popular, actually, you know, in the States. I never found them to be huge the way they were but they've stayed in the consciousness. And in some ways, they've become more popular after Jim's death. I talk to a lot of 17, 18-year-olds that have heard the music and are very much with it.
What are you doing for a period feel in the film?
Oh, we hit all the bases. We have to, you know. It's amazing in 20 years what happens. I mean, I thought it would be relatively simple to shoot, but everything was a pain in the ass. I mean, every street you take over, mailboxes, cars, the clothing, the makeup on the women, for example. I was going crazy waiting for the women extras to come out, and they'd say, well, they got to put more makeup on. And then I'd cast these beautiful young women, and they'd go into makeup, and they'd come out looking horrible. And I said, you know, something's wrong here. It's like, they said, no, this is the way the women were. They were very made up and a little bit overdressed. I mean, I don't think the styles were particularly flattering. But as I remember, they were breakthrough styles back then. They were colorful people. You know, people never had dressed that way. It was a great moment in the film. We were in San Francisco shooting Haight-Ashbury. And we were shooting, we set up one whole sidewalk, signage, all the streets had to be changed, the shops. And we had 500 extras in wonderful yellows and reds and blues walking down the street, and all hippies and stuff. And I looked across the street on the other side, and there were all these tourists had come and were looking. And they were all gray and black and dark in clothing. And I said, I should take my camera now, like a Godard movie, and you pan from all the hippies in the 60s. You swing across the street for about two beats, and you see like the 90s looking at the 60s, and then you go back across the street to the 60s. That would have been a great moment in the movie. I never did it, though.
Is there a character in the film who's your surrogate?
My surrogate? No. Who would that be? You
mean, I don't know. The Oliver Stone character.
Sure, Jim. Yeah. The character... I identified with him in a lot of ways. I would have liked to have led that kind of life where you're breaking on through and testing things all the time. I do in my own way. I respect him as a writer, and I think he wanted to be a director of films if he had lived. He always talked about going back to filmmaking. He was a UCLA film student before he became a rock musician.
Oliver Stone, recorded in 1990. A new DVD box set collects most of his movies. It comes in two editions, one with 6 films, one with 10. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's a scene from Stone's film, The Doors.
I came up with something. A minor and F sharp. Untrue, know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. G-A-D.
Yeah, nice.
Try to set the night on fire.
That's great, Robbie. You got some nice changes in
there.
Any
more lyrics?
Yeah, I got some. I call it Light My Fire. If I'm gonna compete with your stuff, it better be about earth, snakes, or fire.
I like it. Sounds like the birds, though, man. But I like it. I like it. It's good. A little Latin beat will do it some justice.
Maybe put a couple
start
long
over,
solos over, like
start over.
Like Coltrane did on My Favorite Things.
Start over, man.
A minor, B minor, it's jazz.
Yeah, man, yeah.
Need some kind of intro.
No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love becomes a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from Random House Incorporated's Island Books Division. Publisher of Losing Julia by Jonathan Hull, a novel set during World War I and today. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Johanna Fateman and Kathleen Hanna of the band La Tigra. Hanna used to front the band Bikini Kill and is considered one of the founders of the Riot Girl movement. La Tigra has a new CD. And Henry Sheehan reviews Pollock, starring Ed Harris as Jackson Pollock.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman are co-founding members of the band La Tigra. The band just released a new EP called From the Desk of Mr. Lady. Here's the first track, Get Off the Internet. Music by La Tigra, the Riot Girl movement that started in the early 90s produced girl bands with a punk sensibility and a feminist attitude. Kathleen Harris and Johanna Fateman of La Tigra were important members of that movement. In the days when Hanna fronted the band Bikini Kill, she was considered one of the founders of the Riot Girl movement. The movement spread through zines as well as music. Johanna Fateman writes zines about music, art, and culture. La Tigra is touring in Japan right now. From their eponymous first CD, here's a song called What's Your Take on Cassavetes?
We've talked about it in letters, and we've talked about it on the phone. But how you really feel about it, I don't really know.
Kathleen Hanna, Johanna Fateman, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with what's your take on Cassavetes. Why don't you tell us how this song came about, particularly the lyric?
Hi, this is Johanna. Well, with what's your take on Cassavetes, it was kind of a series of incidents or coincidences that led to the song. I work at an art gallery, and there was a group show of visual artists sort of grouped together based on the filmmaking practices of Cassavetes. And so I was reading all this stuff about Cassavetes. And meanwhile, Kathleen and Sadie, well, you should tell this part, Kathleen.
This is Kathleen. Sadie and I happened to hook up in Paris, France. It was very glamorous. And we wanted to go see a movie and what was playing but Husbands by Cassavetes. And we went to see it and we just had like all these conversations about, you know, is the misogyny in this movie calling attention to sort of like white middle class men's like spiritual vacancy and stuff like that? Or is it just being a part of it? Because we both felt really gross after the movie, but we also loved it in this weird way. And we started talking about how many different kinds of art and music we feel that way about, that it's like there's something really icky about it, but we still are attracted to it, and how can you constantly be negotiating that in your mind about everything as a feminist? And so we started writing that song, and then we also wanted to bring up the point of me, Sadie, and Johanna's sort of intellectual friendships with each other, because at the beginning of the song, there's like a girl in a telephone booth, you can hear seagulls and stuff like that in the background, and we've kind of set it up to be a typical, you know, Shangri-La's type thing where, you know, one girl's calling another, you know, and being like, oh, I love that man so much, I'm going to die without him or whatever. And then it's really one woman calling another being like, what do you think about Cassavetes? I really need to know.
Well, I think it's really ambitious to write a song about your ambivalent feelings about a film director, your ambivalent feelings about certain art. It's hard to write a song about that.
Not for us. That's what we talk about all the time.
Well, it's certainly not typical to write a song about that.
I think that's part of what we wanted to do with the song, though, is to overturn that expectation that it was going to be about typical pop song fare of, you know, love relationships or whatever, having a good time at a party or what, I don't know, whatever common themes are. So we wanted to address this idea of, like, what's a critique and what's a participation.
Kathleen, you're considered one of the originators of Riot Girl music. I think most artists really hate labels. So let's start with, are you comfortable with that expression?
I'm definitely comfortable with being labeled a feminist artist. Like, I kind of hate the fact that everybody's so freaked out about being labeled. I'm sick of reading it in everybody's interviews. You know, every single interview is like, don't put me in a box. I don't want to be labeled. And it's like, I'm really happy when I see people who are like, I'm a lesbian and I'm really proud of it. You know what I mean? And like, go ahead, label me, because that's something that like gives other people pride and gives other people a feeling of inclusion. So in terms of like feminism, I'm definitely down to say I'm a feminist. Riot Girl is a specific branch of feminism, but I wouldn't call myself a Riot Girl just because I don't go to meetings anymore.
What was it when you were involved with it, and what was its meaning for you?
It was sort of like, you know, 70s feminist CR groups a lot, with a certain like outreach element of like, you know, doing actions like being involved in protests and stuff like that, and planning benefit shows for like rape crisis shelters, helping out individual women in the sort of punk music scene, skill sharing, stuff like that. It was really, it meant a lot to me. I mean, it was a really exciting time when it started in DC, just to be a part of these meetings and see these girls who had never been in a room only with women before, you know, saying things that maybe they'd never said, and saying things certainly that I'd never said to anyone.
Well, I'm wondering if, you know, having started out with Riot Girl music, if you felt that some of that music was appropriated by mainstream groups and by mainstream pop culture, say groups like the Spice Girls or TV shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I don't think the music was ever appropriated, because probably to mainstream listeners, it's just too confrontational and unlistenable and has too many cuss words in it. But it definitely, I think, certain people who are interested in graphs and charts and marketing saw that bands like Bikini Kill and Bratmobile and now Sleater-Kinney were making, you know, a living on small independent labels with absolutely like no advertising money, you know? And like, if we're able to do that, they were like, what if we put a whole bunch of money behind something that sort of takes the content out of it, takes the abrasiveness out of it, and yet has this sort of, you know, girl power message or whatever, and put that into the world? We could make a lot of money. And, you know, whatever. All the Girls Rules t-shirts started happening, and we a lot of Riot Girls used to write stuff on themselves, you know, like names that were like derogatory towards women, like on our arms or on our stomachs if we were wearing a short top, sort of as a commentary.
Like slut, like you had slut on your stomach.
Yeah, like stuff like that. And it was sort of, part of the original reason was when I started being photographed, I felt like I was silenced by the photograph, you know what I mean? Like I would get my picture taken in and they could write absolutely anything over it, under it, whatever. And now it's kind of depressing because I'm like, oh, I was beating people to the punch. You know what I mean? Like, oh, that's what men are going to think if they see me. And so I'm going to beat them to the punch by writing this and say, I know you're thinking that, which I think was interesting for a minute, but I'm not kind of interested in that thing anymore. Mm-hmm. But the basic point is that then they start having t-shirts that said slut. And who are the people who own these companies? Probably men. Do you know what I mean? Who are making money off of this, like, now pseudo-rebellion. And, whatever. I just find it annoying and boring, and I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. I just kind of keep working. And if there are like 5-year-old girls who get sort of a feminist type vibe off of the Spice Girls' girl power, great.
My guests are co-founders of the band La Tigra, Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back.
Let's get back to our interview with two members of the band La Tigra, Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman. Now, Kathleen, I read, and you can tell me if this is true, that when you were in school, you started a production of Annie.
Yes, that is true. I was Annie. My school couldn't really afford props and sets and stuff, and they also had to have something with a male lead to be fair, I guess. So it was sort of a combination of Annie and Oliver. I don't know how they did it. And then it was like I had a stuffed dog instead of a real dog for Sandy. It's really bad.
So did you have to sing The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow?
I sure did.
No, that's a really different kind of singing than the singing you're doing on your records now.
Not really. I mean, the thing that's interesting is when I first started out or whatever, everybody said I sounded like polystyrene from X-Ray Specs. And I had never heard her. And then I listened to X-Ray Specs and I was like, oh, it's because we both project. Like, and I learned that from like my many years of children's theater. and I always wondered if Polly also had done a little, you know.
Little Annie. Theater in her day?
Yeah.
See, I thought you meant when you started singing and Annie, people said that you sounded like polystyrene. That was pretty funny.
I wish.
Yeah. I'm going to play something, Kathleen, that you did with the band Bikini Kill early in your music career. And this is called Rebel Girl, and it's considered like one of the anthems of Riot Girl music. And tell us something about writing this song.
Well, I lived in D.C. at the time, and there was just a lot of excitement because women's groups were starting, and there were a lot of bands there. And I don't know, at that point, I didn't feel like I had to write songs. I just felt like I had to reach up into the air and grab them. And this was one of the ones I sort of reached up into the air and grabbed. It was like a scene of people wrote it. I didn't really write it. I just was the person who actually put the pen to the paper.
Okay, this is Rebel Girl, Bikini Kill, featuring my guest, Kathleen Hanna. That's Rebel Girl from the band Bikini Kill that my guest Kathleen Hanna used to be in. And Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman are my guests. Their new band is called La Tigra. You've both talked about the importance of feminism in your life and in your music. How were you exposed to that? And I'm wondering if your mothers were a feminist.
My mom's a feminist, definitely. I mean, I grew up in Berkeley, California, which, you know, is a university town and sort of famous for being a place where, you know, radical politics are talked about. So I feel like I was exposed to radical ideas when I was really young.
I grew up in suburbia, in various suburbias. My family moved a lot. We moved every, like, 3 years. My dad worked for the union, for Local 669, pipe fitters and welders. And my mom has always been a nurse at various, like, mental health facilities. My mom was kind of, like, a secret feminist. Like, she didn't really, you know, it wasn't like we had, like, any bohemian friends or, you know what I mean? Like, pretty much the books in our house were, like, romance novels and detective novels. But my mom worked in this sort of, like, clandestine domestic violence shelter. And I didn't remember this until a couple years ago. I just remember her kind of sneaking out of the house to this... I think it was like an Episcopal church that had a phone, you know, crisis phone line thing in the basement. And she would go there every so often and do that. And she got Ms. Magazine. And She took me to Solidarity Day in D.C. when I was like, I don't know, 10 or something. And we saw Bella Abzug speak. And all these women were wearing like T-shirts that said, you know, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. I was just caught up in the total frenzy of it as like a little kid being like, look at all these women. And it was like the outside world, you know, and the fact that there are all these women banding together and like yelling stuff, it just really had an impression on me. And hearing Bella Abzug speak was like, I couldn't believe it.
A lot of girls, when they're preteens, go through this phase of, it's the oh, he's so cute phase, where like you listen to music and you're supposed to have, you know, oh, he's so cute fantasies about the guys you're listening to and so on. And I'm wondering if you ever related to music that way. For example, now, you know, like if you see clips of, say, an NSYNC concert, it's almost all preteen girls in the audience and they're kind of screaming and, you know, obviously having all these really important fantasies to them about the guys who are in the band. Did you relate to music that way at all when you were 11, 12, 10?
I was like 6 or something. I was really into Donny Osmond. That was my first concert. And I went and I screened myself totally hoarse. But, you know, I think I really wanted to be Donny. That was the real issue going on. And I mean, I actually wrote more love letters to Marie than I ever did to Donny, because I was really kind of obsessed with her. But I felt like it was more acceptable to channel my, you know, fake love energy into Donny. But I was also really into Tony DeFranco and the DeFranco family and would imitate his singing style along with the records.
Do you think about the impact your music and your presence on stage might have for your youngest fans? What it might mean in their lives?
I thought about it once in Italy with Bikini Kill when there were these like 7-year-old girls sitting by the monitors. I just thought, oh, they're going to be in therapy when they're like 35 and there's this girl and her face was all red and she was screaming these crazy things and people were saying she was a man hater and I don't know, was it a dream doctor? But I just think I would really like to have been young and gone to a concert and seen Joe on stage singing and playing keyboards. And I'd really like to go to a concert when I was younger and see me in all my beauty and sexual glory and fabulous singing style on stage. So I get really happy about it. You know, I think that people are pretty incredible and that they don't really need me to become amazing people. But if I'm someone there who reminds them that they're really cool, then that's great.
I'm glad you mentioned your sexual glory. What kind of sexual energy do you want to communicate on stage? Because that's often a really important part of pop music and of concerts.
I'm just like really sexually powerful person in general. Maybe that's a, you know, braggy thing to say, but it's like I get what I want and I have a good time, and it's like, I really get annoyed. Well, I got annoyed in Bikini Kill when it was like, it was never women that said this stuff. It was always guys who were like, you know, well, how can you be a feminist because, like, you're sexy? And it's like, I'm sexy when I'm eating a veggie burger, you know what I mean? So, like, what am I going to do, like, just turn it off? Am I being really funny, Joe? I have to brag.
No, it's fine. I mean, it's never gone down this road in an interview before.
You haven't been to some of the interviews where I've gone down this road. No, but I mean, I think it's like we're all like totally sexual beings. And it's like I really hate the idea that if you're a feminist or something, you're supposed to shut that off because people see that as antithetical to your politics or something. And that's ridiculous.
Well, Kathleen Hanna, Johanna Fateman, I thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman are co-founders of La Tigra. From their new EP, here's a track called They Want Us to Make a Symphony Out of the Sound of Women Swallowing Their Own Tongues. You may recognize a voice that's sampled on the track, Ray Suarez of Public Radio and TV.
Well, what is it that younger women are pushing up against? They would seem to have a list of options to choose from, a set of ways to construct their own identity that takes in everything. It's just a vast smorgasbord. The options are not as narrow as they might have been 30 years ago. Where does the problem lie now?
I think that
Coming up, a review of the new movie Pollock. This is Fresh Air. Two stars of the movie Pollock received Academy Award nominations this week, Ed Harris for his role as the painter Jackson Pollock, and Marcia Gay Harden for her portrayal of Pollock's wife, the painter Lee Krasner. Ed Harris also directed the film. Pollock is opening in many cities this month and next. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
If you know anything at all about the abstract expressionist painter Jackson Pollock, there's no real reason for you to go out and see Pollock. Continuing a trend that surfaced in Julian Schnabel's Basquiat and James Ivory's Surviving Picasso, Pollock has as little to do with painting as possible. The focus instead is on celebrity melodrama. Although actor-director Ed Harris's filmmaking style turns out to be rudimentary, he does manage to open the movie with a shot that eloquently compresses his interests. It begins on an issue of Life magazine with a photo spread on Pollock. The magazine is being held in the hand of an unknown woman who, in slow motion, begins to make her way through a crowd of people in what turns out to be an art gallery. She finally ends up in front of Pollock, who gives her an autograph and then looks up and off into the distance with a sphinx-like gaze. Since we're in an art gallery, there are some paintings in the shot, though they are only fuzzily glimpsed in the background. For what we're about to see is a tale of the painter as rock star, the boozing and womanizing figure beloved of 1,000 adoring magazine profiles. The movie opens in 1941 with Pollock living in Manhattan and on the eve of both his artistic breakthroughs and public acclaim. We see him as he meets and marries fellow artist Lee Krasner, played by Marcia Gay Harden, and passes through a final figurative stage in his art. Finally, at a Long Island hideaway far from the city's boozy distractions, Pollock discovers the drip technique that would secure both his contemporary fame and artistic immortality. To express all this, the film falls back on the hoariest of biopic cliches. It depicts Pollock's drip technique as the consequence of an accidental spill. Krasner delivers clumsily scripted, potted descriptions of Pollock's influences and developments, and the critic Clement Greenberg, played by Jeffrey Tambor, occasionally heaves into sight to pronounce on the modernism of it all. But Pollock does tell us something about the Motion Picture Academy and the upcoming Academy Awards. Here's a clip of Oscar nominees Harris and Harden.
Let's make a baby.
No.
No.
Am I missing something here? Are you missing something?
We can't.
We can't?
My life is full enough with you, Jackson.
Wait a minute, where are you going? Don't walk away from me. We're husband and wife. I want to have a baby, our baby. That's what the progression of things is about. That's what the union is about.
That's not what the union is about.
Well, what else is there?
That's not what it's about, Jackson.
For me?
The vows don't stipulate baby. I am not going to bring another life into that. We are painters, Jackson. We don't have any money. We don't get by. We struggle. But you are a great artist. I believe in Jackson Pollock. And there's you, and there's the painting, and you need.
Pollock doesn't just fulfill the conventions of a Hollywood artist biography. It's also a guide to the sort of overacting the Academy eats up. Like a bat to a bug, the movie relentlessly swoops down on the most melodramatic aspects of Pollock's life, particularly those moments when he expressed rage or Krasner announced her frustrations. Each time, Harrison Hardin cut loose with theatrical explosions that are more geared to reach the second balcony than to actually expose complex and creative personalities. When not shouting at the gallery gods, Hardin spends much of the movie fussing. Not a prop goes by that she doesn't handle. Since Harris directed the film, he doesn't have to do much to attract the camera's attention. Frequently, he goes into a freeze, standing still and pulling that 10-mile gaze. Invariably, the camera finds this posture irresistible and rushes up to record it. It's possible to make a good film about a painter. There's Alexander Korda's Rembrandt and Vincente Minnelli's Lust for Life. But those films connected at least as much with the artist's work as with the biography. Harris is fatally distracted by Pollock's life, or at least the parts that glitter with the tinsel of picturesque suffering.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today was Bob Purdick. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, what little moonlight can do. Oh, what little moonlight can do to you. You're in love, your hearts are fluttering all day long. You're only steady cause your poor time.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air for President's Day, we feature presidential speeches from the 20th century, also rules for getting out of tough spots from Marlon Fitzwater, who was press secretary under Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.